Welcome to Holden Village. Today is the 26th of July, 1995. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Thomas Fiutak, and he will be speaking on social change, cultural shift. So let's listen in on Thomas.
We're here to discuss social shift and cultural conflict and the politics of language. Welcome. I have co-presenters along with me as well who will be signing for three sessions. And I want to say how happy I always am to have these people with me, because I always feel that when I have an interpreter, whether it's with the deaf community or if I'm in the middle of Bulgaria, that I oftentimes feel that they make a lot more sense of what I say than I land up doing when I'm saying what I'm saying. So they're valuable, valuable individuals. Let me tell you very briefly about what I hope to happen. First of all, self-disclosure, I'm a flaming intuiter, which means that titles and I'm envious of people like Walt, who can give lectures in a nice prepared way and saying, here's the map that I'm going to go through, and I can go from step to step. I am handicapped in that respect, that for me to enjoy what I do, I have to tell you up front the chasm that exists between where I'm beginning and where we may end. That's always part of the joy of life for me. I want to begin with some stories, because I enjoy telling stories as a way to begin to help build the frame. My background has been multiple. I've had multiple lives, as we all have. And one of the things that I've always enjoyed doing in my life is traveling and having the opportunity to go ahead and experience a lot of different levels of a lot of different places. Well, one of the intriguing notions of an intuiter is that he or she always assumes that everything is connected. All you need to do is kind of bump into enough ideas and things, and somehow you begin to strain out what seems to be the connective tissue between the various parts. Having the opportunity to come here to Holden gives me that opportunity to kind of say, well, here are a number of different parts, and here are some hints of where I think these things are connected. And not just for the sake of saying, yes, they are connected or not, but because I think some of these things that we're trying to deal with are really important in terms of the way in which we lead our lives and in the way in which we see things develop in our society and in our cultures. That it's not just meant as something to kind of reflect on as much as it is to say, what does this tell us about what we can do in order to change things? I am part of a center, a research center at the University of Minnesota in the Humphrey Institute. And we began in 1986, and we began with a rather curious title. It was called, and it still is called, the Conflict and Change Center. And I say it's curious because the intent is that we do research and we do teaching and outreach in the area of social conflict to understand the role that conflict plays in change of societies and organizations, and then the role that negotiating skills and cooperative problem solving plays in that relationship between social conflict and change. But more and more, now that we're about 8 years old, that initial title begins to make more sense to us. Because, and I say that, you know, up front, we didn't choose that out of wisdom. We chose that more out of the questions that we had. What we want to explore here, then, is some basic constructs that we think begin to make sense to us. And very particularly, to be able to make some application of those ideas and constructs to the deaf community. And why the deaf community? Well, why did we choose conflict and change as a title 8 years ago? It's one of those type of serendipitous things that I became involved with the deaf community for reasons which I don't understand, but I do understand kind of some of the sequence of events. And by having had the opportunity, and I really do mean that in almost a blessing way, to work with the deaf community, it has uncovered for me some of the sense of what I see happen in a wide variety of areas. So how can you connect what I see taking place in the ex-Soviet Union with what I've had the opportunity to see take place in Poland, in Moldova, in the Philippines, in beginning to understand a little bit more about the role that cultures play and how we may go about thinking of shifting and changing inside. While that is seen is in oftentimes a very practical, pragmatic, very application-oriented way, having had the chance to deal with the deaf community has given me an opportunity to kind of look at it in a different perspective. By the way, let me answer the question, how did I get involved with the deaf community? I've had no experience with the deaf prior to 1989, other than knowing them as a subgroup or a subculture or whatnot. One of the roles I was playing at the University of Minnesota was I was invited by a group of a dozen women to be a mediator. Six of these women were Israeli, six of these women were Palestinian, and they wanted to hold an ongoing dialogue regarding the ramifications of the Intifada, which was the awakening of the question of the Palestinian issue. And I was chosen as a mediator for a lot of very good reasons, which probably has a lot to do why I've had the opportunity to work with the deaf. In that I wasn't female, I wasn't Palestinian, I wasn't Jewish, I wasn't a whole bunch of things, which the longer the list of the you are not or wasn'ts made you more eligible to be able to play the role of neutral. So there's something about being invisible that is healthy, which is kind of a paradox. I became part of that discussion, the national dialogue. They held a meeting in Boston. I was invited to come along with the groups that were dealing with ACMED, or the American Coalition of Middle East Dialogue Groups, being a really grassroots program. You didn't stay in a motel, you stayed with families. By the will of someone, I landed up staying with a family. And the woman in that family had just taken on a job with the Learning Center for Deaf Children in Framingham, Massachusetts. So we would talk all day long about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. At night, we would stay up all night talking about, boy, there seems to be some similarities that I'm seeing in this school because we seem to have some of the same things going on. 6 months later, she invited me to talk to the people at the Learning Center for Deaf Children to see if we can begin this discussion, because she had recognized that we were beginning to see some of those social shifts because of her position in that school, and that maybe some of the things I've been trying to kick around and understanding cultural conflict may have some application to what was happening there in Boston. That then led to some work with the deaf school in New York. Then it spread to working with the deaf community in Ontario, Canada, and then with the Washington School for the Deaf. So when somebody asks how did I get involved with the deaf community, it all started with the Palestinians. And but that's the way I think real life works. I have three stories I want to start with. And the first one, sadly to say, is a rather sad story. My wife is Filipina. I've had the opportunity to be in the Philippines on a couple of occasions. And one of the things I became aware of in the Philippines is more and more about the cultural interactions that have taken place and the results of being dominated by the Spaniards for 300 to 400 years and by the United States for another 100 years. And what seems to be now the direct result of that kind of cultural washing, inhibition, oppression for all those many years. And it all crystallized in a very kind of unique time. There was a traveling theater that was going through the United States of Filipinos. And they had put together a specific theater group. And it was a play celebrating an ethnic group in northern Luzon called the Entex. And this was an Aboriginal group who had fought for years against the inroads of cultures to be able to take away their lands, use it for lumber and strip the earth, put up dams to be able to create hydroelectric, which meant it would flood their villages and their sacred grounds, and the ongoing fight that they had been in for years. And this play was supposed to be a celebration of that conflict. Okay? And one of the threads of the play was that there was a song that they used, and they were very proud of the fact that even anthropologists who had gone back to the Entix had discovered this song that they considered to be kind of a sacred song, a song that was way back in their past, and that somehow was this ongoing threat into the future. And that, in fact, what they did in the play is they used some tapes of taping the original song back in Luzon. And then, in fact, was then reverberated by the actors. Now, my background in my previous life was that of, I come from a family of musicians. My father was a musician, my mother was a musician. I've always had music around me. So music to me is as constant a language as my English is. And I walked away from that play humming the tune. I mean, because it was melodious and nice, and I kept playing it back to myself, back to myself, back to myself. And then it was like another day later, it dawned on me, I said, boy, isn't that a coincidence? It sounds like the old song I learned and sang in Glee Club called Shenandoah. I'm pretty sure you know it or heard it. Shenandoah, da 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 da, da 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 dee dee dee. That main frame, okay? And it just bugged me. I said, boy, what a coincidence. Is it the fact that somebody came to the U.S. and actually wrote that after having wandered through the hills of Luzon and actually kind of translated that? I would have been curious, because they were saying, this is an old song. This is one that reflects our ancestors. Well, I did some digging and I asked some questions. I was just, you know, I'm not Filipino. I'm asking about a different culture. Well, it turns out that in the time, in the 1700s, late 1700s, when the Philippines were dominated by the Spaniards, one of the things the missionaries did, the Catholic missionaries who were coming from the United States at that time as well, they went into the Philippines attempting to go ahead and carry on the Christian and this very specific Catholic culture to these tribal groups. And there was one particular missionary who worked in the Entik area and in fact taught these people the Shenandoah song, because that was one of the few he remembered. Because it Shenandoah apparently, while we think of it as American, it comes from a tune that came from Ireland. I mean, there's some kind of historical connection. I may be wrong, but there's that pathing that goes through. Only to find out, and this is the sad part, that these people who think they have an Aboriginal culture, their culture has been so destroyed, so corrupted, so corroded, that they aren't even sure what is the essence of their culture. The Spaniards and the Americans have so thoroughly robbed them of their past that they are confused regarding the origins of who they are. Some people say, if you want to destroy a culture, take away their future. I say, if you truly want to destroy a culture, take away their past. Okay. Story number two. I'm in Moldova. Now, Moldova is a country that used to be part of the old Soviet Union. It sits to the west of the Black Sea and just south of the Ukraine and whatnot. I was there in 1993. I was there the weekend and the week and the 2 weeks, matter of fact, of the coup of 1993 when they were blowing up the White House and in Moscow. That's a whole other story. But one of the interesting things about the Moldovan experience was that now that the ex-Soviet Union had collapsed, Moldova was going through a situation where they had to decide what is the culture of Moldova. They had to make a decision because they had gone through 40-some years, at least, of dominance by the Soviet Union, even further if you go back to the 70s, if you go back to the initiation of the Russian Revolution, but dominated to the extent that the official language was Russian. In other words, the elite of the group, in order to be able to rise in the ranks, you had to know Russian. But the cultural tug, the cultural pull was south, was towards Romania, which is the country just below it. Right? Now that they had become independent or quasi-independent or were no longer part of Russia but were now part of that kind of group of ex-republics, they made a law. They said in the middle of January of, I think it was 94, we are going to have a test and everybody's going to have to take the test. And anybody who has a public job, stewardesses, doctors, people who work in travel agencies, whomever, teachers, all are going to have to take a test. And they're going to have to take a test to find out whether or not they can speak the state language. That was the term, the state language. All right? Okay. Lo and behold, when they started figuring out, now they're going to make the test out, then they figured out that nobody was quite sure what the state language was. Because not only did you have this one layer of, say, Russian, well, it's not going to be Russian because we are no longer part of the Soviet Union, so we know what it isn't. But now the question is, what is it? Because culture has this very interesting effect. That is, it exists not only as something which is integral to itself. In other words, it has a sense of gravity, internal gravity. It also means that it is in distinction to some other culture. So that if, in fact, there was only one culture, there would be no culture. Right? Understand? I mean, if it was, it's the old fish in water problem. That the last thing the fish is aware of is water. Because it is everywhere. It is all the same. So in fact, it is indistinguishable from something else. So here's the problem the Moldovans face. Do we talk about the state language, meaning the street language, which was a language of Moldovan, in other words, the Romanian that they spoke in the 1930s and 1940s? Or is it really Romanian, because Moldovan is much more like Romanian than anything, and Romanian was a contemporary language. It stayed contemporary. It had contemporary words with it. You could converse in terms of 1990 and 1994 in terms of Romanian language. But if you talked Moldovan, you were talking about a time-cast language that worked up until the 30s and 40s and then became ossified. It kind of became like a bone. It became hard. And what people had hoped for in terms of the state language was they were saying, we want to be Moldovan back like it used to be prior to the times of the Soviets. But nope, that's a nice idea. But when it came to the reality of conversing, it was not a practical language to be able to use. The reason why I mention this story is that we're talking about a political system here, a country that has had a history from the time when it was a duchy of Moldova and part of, I think at one point in time, the Holy Roman Empire. It certainly was part of the Austrian-Hungary coalition, and has been shifted and changed back and forth almost as much as Poland had been, depending on what time of the latest several centuries you're reading the book or looking at the map. So now they had the cultural question to resolve. We have a conflict, because what is the Moldovan culture? And if language displays culture, do we go back to the 40s, or do we go ahead and reinvent and reconstruct Moldovan so that, in fact, it becomes a contemporary language? Third story. One of the most powerful experiences in working with the deaf came the second time I had a chance to meet with the Learning Center for Deaf Children in Framingham, Massachusetts. We gathered in a room not unlike this. It was an old barn that had been reconstructed, and they had a kind of a terraced effect around like this. And we brought all 128 staff and faculty together, about a third of whom were deaf, two-thirds of which were hearing. And what I wanted to do was raise the question for them about how does one carry out cooperative disputing? How does one recognize that conflict, social conflict, has to take place? You don't have a choice to deny it any longer. It's right in your face. Matter of fact, you see it in ways that other people don't. You know you've got to go. It's kind of the Gethsemane discussion. I can't get around it. I know I'm going to go through it, but can I do it any other way than having to get nailed to the cross? My purpose is to say there are options. But in order to be able to raise that, we had to step back and we had to ask the same question that the Moldovans did. We had to go ahead and raised the same issue that got raised by the NTICs. Okay. And that is, you have got to begin to understand what you know and what you don't know about your own culture before you can begin to go ahead and make that next step. And it was in this discussion, and I thought it was relatively benign, because being an academic, you also kind of talk in things as if, you know, it's one of the benefits of being an academic. You don't think it has an effect oftentimes. My life has changed in 5 years from that point in time, because it's not much fun for me anymore unless I feel that I'm making an impact someplace. Halfway through this discussion, one of the deaf faculty stood up. Young man, about 28, 29 years old, had gone through the school as a student, had stayed on, had got his degree, was now teaching in the school. And in the Learning Center for Deaf Children, they would wear, some of the students would wear what they would refer to as the box. Now, the box is something that this school would do routinely to any student who walked in the door. Whenever they started, no matter what age, they would give them this auditory device. I have no idea about the mechanics of it, but it was an amplifier of sorts. And it was whether or not the child could go ahead and physically signal that he or she could pick up any kind of audio. So the assumption was, well, if you have it on, that way, if in fact something does come through audibly, you'll get it, and your chances are you'll get it better. Okay. And this man, this faculty member, was wearing the box because his students would all wear the box. Well, he stood up, and he ripped it off of his neck, and he threw it against the wall. And he threw it against the wall, and then he communicated, saying, "This is like the shackle of a slave." He says, "I've never said this to anybody before, but every day I put this on my neck, I don't know why I'm supposed to put this on my neck. I didn't understand the first time it was put on my neck. I don't understand why I put it on this morning. But I do understand that when I put that around my neck, the one thought that was in my mind was that I am a minority culture, and in order to survive in the majority culture, I have to wear this as a signal of my slavery." And that was the analogy he made. So here was an awakening. Here was an identification that something was shifting underneath their feet. Okay. I want to talk about the notion of social shift. For the remainder of this morning, I want to just lay out some concepts for you. Okay. Just some frameworks to talk about. Because the next time we meet, and I hope you come tomorrow, I want to then take some information, and I'm an academic and we still do research, and I've got some really interesting data from the Washington School for the Deaf and from the Ontario group, because I want to lay that data in front of you, and I want you to see how and to discuss with me how you interpret what looks like different elements and levels of cultural conflict. The third time we meet, by the way, I want us to move it on a different level. Because I want the discussion to go, instead of just thinking about change in terms of something that casually happens or happens by a whole series of external forces, what happens when we move from social shift to social justice? So that what we begin to do is say we are no longer just simply the observers, but that in fact we have not just a calling, we have an obligation to go ahead and say what is intentional change and what constitutes the justice side of the shift. So those are kind of the three layers. First, we want to talk about the conceptual pieces. Want to talk about data and a very specific example of how cultures conflict and some information that I think is helpful for me. And then thirdly, that idea of looking at the notion of social shift. First of all, let's talk about social shift. To me, by social shift, I mean it's kind of like a tectonic question. It's like the shifting of tectonic plates in the earth. Very difficult to detect, very tough to measure, but it is ongoing shifting of massive pieces of something. And then as these things shift, pressure is built up. And that pressure then has to escape in some respects. One of the ways in which that pressure escapes is through cultural conflict, because that's one of the areas that I want to talk about. Okay. Now, when social systems shift, I don't want to talk about why they shift necessarily right now, but just that they do. And that one of the things that happens when we talk about cultural conflict is that we sometimes make the mistake that the culture is in fact in front of itself, being able to predict and go ahead and make the shift, when in fact the cultural conflict is oftentimes a behavior or a result where that in fact the culture is feeling that pressure, is acting and behaving oftentimes for reasons they are not even certain. But just like when they try to detect earthquakes, and you can see how successful we've been with that. But some people have some theories. They can, you know, when the dogs and the cats and the cows and do certain things, they react because they pick up pressure and they go ahead and our signals. You know, you can measure as the ground actually moves and shifts. There's a number of different ways to do it, but there are signals. There are signals. I want to talk a little bit about that relationship between that pressure buildup and the cultural conflicts itself. Okay. Now, in cultural conflict, I mean, start with some very straight definitions. When I use the term conflict, I mean it very specifically, in that it has to have three conditions. Conflict has to have, number one, an interdependency. That's an E. An interdependency of parties. I need more than two people, or at least a healthy schizophrenic, to have conflict. Because conflict comes from the Latin conflictus, meaning striking one another or striking with someone else. I have to have, so it's not independence of one another, it has to have some sense of interdependency. Number two, I have to have the perception, and that's the key term, I have to have the perception of incompatible goals. Now, I want to strike the difference between the notion of conflict and a dispute, because we oftentimes use those terms as if, in fact, they are similar. A dispute is a time, place, behavior that tests the level of conflict. Right. So a dispute can be resolved. I, as a mediator, as a trainer of mediators, as a coordinator of mediation programs and whatnot, I know when there is a dispute, because you can name it, you can define it, there's a process it can go through, and then it either has been resolved or it has not been resolved. The question is, does it have any effect on the conflict? Because a conflict where there's interdependency, perception of incompatible goals, and thirdly, the notion that one party is attempting to block the other's goals. This is where the dispute takes place. I have to have an action or a behavior where, in fact, the blocking takes place. It's not good enough just to have interdependency and a perception of incompatible goals. I can have a conflict, but I don't necessarily have a dispute. The dispute lands up right over here, where the blocking takes place. All right. Now, what happens when we talk about cultural conflict? Now, with these conditions then, I can have, and this we'll explore more, and we have some interesting data on it, we have two types of culture conflicts. One where, because a specific culture is beginning to make that shift, that societal shift, for whatever reasons, either understood or not understood, you begin to get a variety or a variation within the culture. People begin to act and react differently. Where the notion of culture is a centrality, as a kind of a sense of gravity, things begin to split apart because the culture is being tested by the pressure of the society. Okay. So I can have that internal type. I also can have an external type of cultural conflict where, as I said before, in order to define a culture, I have to know a different culture as well so that I can define the differences. Much of the problem in the whole notion of cultural context and the discussion of culture in general is that it's been a discussion of the differences and similarities between and among cultures, which is, from the researcher's point of view, easier to detect than getting into the culture and understanding the culture itself oftentimes. So when we're talking about that external type of conflict, we're talking about, well, okay, what happens when you have got a relationship between, you know, interdependency, perception of incompatible goals, and the idea that you've got a blocking among or between cultures. Now I've got that external type of conflict. So that when we talk about the notion of, for instance, deaf culture and hearing culture, I want to talk about it in terms of both its internal conflict structures as well as its external conflict structures. Politics of change. My definition of politics is a manipulation of the relationship of power, rights, and interests of parties, or individuals, or groups, or systems. Okay? It's a manipulation, meaning it is not a natural act. Political scientists delve in unnatural acts. My best friends are people. It's unnatural because they are not describing natural sequences. They are, in fact, saying what happens when individuals intervene and manipulate. And by the manipulation, you modify the relationship in three primary areas: power, rights, and interest. What's referred to as interests, okay? And when we talk about these strategies of power, rights, and interests, we find in some of the research that we've been doing, because we're trying to understand how organizations conflict and organizational cultures conflict, we have found that there is a fairly secure shibboleth in trying to understand healthy organizations, in other words, organizations that have a healthy conflict culture, versus those organizations that have an unhealthy culture, by the proportion of these three. So that when we discover what we would consider to be healthy organizations, the proportion of those three elements pretty much looks like that, or approximates that, where the amount of power used is subservient to the amount of rights, or, in this, rules of the organization by which disputing takes place, which is subordinate to the interest of the individuals. What do people want and need as the primary question for dealing with the conflict? Now, when you find organizations like this, where power, rights, and interests, we now begin to define the geography of the culture in such a way that we get into intention. Because one of the roles that I play as a manager of conflict is somebody invited in to organizations and to countries and groups and whatnot that are struggling with the notion of how do I go ahead and learn how to conflict better, one of the things that I am trying to conceptualize for them is how do we shift from this configuration to this configuration. So that it's shift, but it's some shift with intention. Now, let's talk briefly about language. By language, I mean a symbolic device to communicate meaning. Right? A symbolic device to communicate meaning. Do dolphins have symbolic devices to communicate meaning? Sure they do. I always love the idea that from the eyes of the dolphin, I am handicapped. Because I can't go ahead and communicate over the course of a quarter or half or almost a mile at a time with multiple individuals from my family at any point in time that I wish to in a language that's complex. I'm forced to have to call on the phone or talk to somebody one-on-one or to be able to learn another language to be able to go ahead and communicate with someone. I also mean to say that the song of the Entic is a language. It's music, but it is a powerful symbolic representation for meaning. And when you get cultures that have high context, what's referred to as high context, that's one of the kind of divisions drawn among cultures. You can kind of lay them on a continuum. Huh? High context means that it's incredibly, their symbols are rich, complex, dense, meaning that they're able to give very powerful pieces of information with highly dense symbolic loading. The low context is where the sensor, if you're talking about the old Myers-Briggs systems, where the sensors rely, where you can take individual little bits and pieces that have a very exact meaning, and you can put them together in a device or a diagram or an equation, and then meaning comes out of the collection of the individual pieces. So that's kind of an extreme definition of high context, low context type of stuff. All right, let me just stop there because I've kind of run through a bunch of definitions. Questions that you have before we move along.
Will you give the definition of language again, please?
Language, for me, is symbolic representation of meaning. I think I used another term as well. It's a consistent symbolic representation of meaning. In other words, it has consistency over time. And the question of symbolism is one where, and symbolism, I think it was in Walt's discussion yesterday, made a nice distinction between symbolism, a symbol and a sign. Okay, whereas a sign can be a random piece of information as opposed to symbol, which has context to it, which has a sense to it of meaning, which is richer than actually the initial piece. It has loading, cultural and contextual loading to it. So that's my notion of language. Any other questions about some things we've been kicking around so far? Okay. I want to go back to the notion of social shift, because we've learned some things about what seems to compel societies to change. What it comes down to is, I suspect you can't see that. Yeah, that's a little bit better. What it comes down to in kind of a conceptual way is that what we find in terms of conflict in organizations and the way in which conflict relates to the notion of change is that we have constantly this mix of external forces. Call this external cultures, environments, whatever you care to, that set up an expectation of this thing, whether this thing is the culture, an organization, a school system, a government system, talk about whatever you want. Sets of expectations of either low or high conflict. And by conflict I mean, as we talked about in that previous definition, interdependency, perception of multiple incompatible goals, and blocking. But what we have is we have personal behavior as well. In other words, individuals act in certain ways of low and hide conflict. And it's the intermix of the individual reaction with the external reaction, a very traditional type of modality, that gives us some conditions inside of organizations and systems and groups that helps us understand how things shift. I'll call this area here real or true peace. Now, in order to understand conflict, you have to understand peace. Some shift of words. Notice I will not talk about conflict resolution, which is a buzzword that's been around for a long time. The more and more we study social conflict, as there's kind of an interesting kind of a anthropological shift that took place in just the last 10 years, we're part at the University of Minnesota of the Hewlett Foundation funded organizations. Hewlett, out of Hewlett-Packard, has done an incredible job of making monies available to do basic research in social conflict. Minnesota is one of 11 universities that have been allowed to do basic research in this area. Okay. If you look at what those institutions call themselves, just about everyone has, except us, not out of wisdom, remember, but just out of luck, call themselves conflict resolution, because the seminal journal was conflict resolution. Morton Deutsch, who was one of the local guides, wrote the book Conflict Resolution and whatnot. One by one, they peeled that term away because we were recognizing that understanding social conflict meant that there's a whole range of things that you want to do with conflict. And in fact, I could argue the real positive aspect of conflict, that in fact, when you see it or the absence of it, one of the positive ways to shift a culture or a society is to increase conflict. Is to increase it. Okay? And so as soon as I say conflict resolution, I have already loaded for you an assumption of what you do with it. Because if I say the real thing is conflict resolution, every time you hear conflict, I put you on a linear good-bad scale, which would mean every time there's more of it, it's bad, and every time there's less of it, it's good. Okay. And that's a very shallow understanding of the dynamics of social conflict. Now, peace then is not the absence of conflict. I wish I'd known that in the 1960s when we were going through the whole civil rights movement. Because that was the dilemma, that was but that was one of the dynamic dilemmas of the 1960s. That is not the absence of conflict. Peace, real peace, is the managing of conflict in a way that maintains or enhances the relationship. Let me do that again. Real peace is the managing of conflict in a way that maintains or enhances the relationship between the parties. Enhancing a relationship may mean the discontinuing of a relationship. The enhancing of a relationship may be honorable divorcing, with the understanding that you now reconstruct a new set of relationships. I also want to talk about the idea of real conflict. Because real conflict means, for me, and this is, if there's any one thing we remember out of this whole show, is that what we're aiming for is trying to discover how we create authentic arenas for disputing. And real conflict means that you have found an arena, and I mean the arena, the term, in a very specific way. Because it's an arena that should be cooperative rather than competitive. But it still has to be a place where people are interactive. It's bounded, meaning that I have to know when I'm inside the arena and when I'm outside of the arena, because the expectations of behavior are different when you're inside the arena and outside of the arena. This is where you want to go when I walk into a group or an organization or a country that's having real problems. We find them in either false conflict, where it's false because we have individuals who are acting as if conflict exists. But there doesn't seem to be anything going on, or very little, in the externality that would cause it. It's false conflict in one respect, in that if somebody is not appreciating that there is something going on out here to cause that, the people in power, okay, we're back into this system like this, right? Okay. The people in power will consider it false because they don't have a clue as to why they would go ahead and act or react that way. In organizations, what we have done is we've spent a lot of time in creating human resource departments to test these people, relocate them, reorient them, kind of massage them, get them back into the workforce, because it's cheaper to do that than find somebody else to replace them. It's a pretty hard-nosed discussion of human resources, though. But we're good at this. I mean, we really are good at this. We are getting very good at understanding that dynamic there. But the assumption, just think about it, the initial assumption of that action or that behavior is that it's false because it somehow doesn't fit with the intentionality of the organization or the culture. While this is not always the easiest thing, far easier to deal with than when you find yourself in false peace. Somebody the other day at supper asked me, well, how, you know, the groups that you work with, where do you find them, you know? Before or after or during this spell of conflict? I normally catch them when they are exhausted. When they have tried everything else and now have to face up the fact that they cannot deny any longer. That there are things happening out here in the external culture that is causing real-time conflict. And that I, or the organization, is in such intense denial that the conflict has to be faced. False peace organizations do things like, going, shh, don't act as if there's a problem. Don't go ahead and modify your behavior. Yes, we know things are happening out there, but we want you to do this. We want you to be low, even though things are high out there. These organizations hemorrhage. And the hemorrhaging takes place by trying to figure out some other way in order to be able to deal with that conflict. Cooperative disputing is being able to find an authentic arena, because the paradox of this is that the only way to get to real peace is to get through real conflict. Okay? Now, when you have cultural conflict and social conflict, something else happens. Because if an external dominant culture, and if you can change personal behavior to say the internal or dominated culture, gets into these interactions, one of the other things that happens is, instead of finding real peace inside of the frame of the old culture, you break out. And now you find an authentic arena that reframes or redefines that whole notion of externality and internality. And now I've got the same set of dynamics. Can I find a way to know, because all things human are conflictful, can I create the new culture in such a way that understands what this arena is going to look like? So once again, I've got that choice. I can now be in a real peace situation inside of that prior culture, or one where I really have the opportunity to break out and say I get to redefine myself over and over again. So the shifting for me, trying to understand the dynamics, okay, especially when we're talking about political shifting that talks about the relationship between power, rights, and interests among parties, is this question: how do you find the real conflict, the arena, choice to be able to create real peace inside of that current dynamic, as well as to be able to reframe itself once again? The deaf culture, which is something we'll explore tomorrow, I believe, is a wonderful example of playing out this dynamic. And what I'm trying to understand and help support them in is how does one create that authentic arena? Understand the relationship that they have with their previous culture and with the culture of what will be. And give them a cooperative option that says, we have ways of building arenas that will make the conflict less competitive. And by doing it in a less competitive way, the chances of coming up with a durable agreement are far greater. And I'll end, because we're getting close to the time, with the question of ethics. I end, but I'll also begin tomorrow with the question of ethics. Because behind this, because I've used terms of intentionality, I've used terms of social justice, what is the ethic of it? For me, there's one ethic involved. And that is, are we creating an arena for disputing that creates a durable agreement? And anything that goes ahead and goes away from an arena that will create a durable agreement becomes unethical. Ethical, not amoral, but an ethical meaning. It goes ahead and slides away from kind of the eschatology, the end point that we are attempting to go ahead and meet. In the study of conflict management, where much of the research has wound its way to is a very simple question. Why do people seem to be able to adhere to an agreement made and in fact live up to it in one condition, but in other conditions will not live up to it? It seems like a very simple question, right? And some of the better researchers have begun to understand the difference between three levels of satisfaction. And the more we test it, the more it seems to have some sense of longevity. That the degree to which two people, three people, four people, whether it's an organization, a group, whether it's a system, the degree to which they can create an agreement that is substantively satisfying, substantively meaning the things that we can count, quantify, that go directly to those things that we want and need, the degree to which I can be substantively satisfied, the degree to which I can be procedurally satisfied, meaning the degree to which I have a sense of power of the process. In other words, the arena, the authentic arena, has to be a creation of mine. I have to have ownership of it. I need to be able to be not only invited in, but have the chance to go ahead and reconstruct. And then thirdly, I have to be psychologically satisfied, which means that I have to have a process and substantive options that are not only acceptable to me, where I do not have to give up my self-esteem, where I do not have to lose my culture, where I do not have to go ahead and disassemble what is in fact my ontology, my own being. And the degree to which this becomes fair, I will have psychological, procedural, substantive satisfaction.